assistance, mentoring, depression, and chronic disease prevention. She is currently the lead evaluator on a CDC grant for state and local public health actions to prevent obesity, diabetes, and heart disease and stroke at the New York State Department of Health. Please welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Okay, so I'm the third presenter here, and everybody's probably feeling a little bit blurry on like the third or fourth day of this conference. So if you wouldn't mind, why don't you just all stand up for a second?
Yeah, that would be a nice way.
Yeah, just stretch. But maybe the way we can do it is I can ask everybody to stay standing if they've heard of the Diabetes Prevention Program or DPP. Oh, wow. All right, great. This saves me some time on my presentation. And if you're very familiar with it, also stay standing. All right, that's good. So that gives me a good sense of it. Thank you. And you guys have both saved me some time by reading my like long title, which actually in public health always we have these acronyms. So our New York State 1422 project, which I will not say the whole title, is actually local impact, which is a lot easier than the full title of that. So let me get started. What I'm going to be talking to you about today, and I'm just acknowledging the co-authors on this, Rachel Austin and Susan Milstein. I really wish Susan was here because she's our program expert, and I'm just thinking at the end of this there's going to be a question, and I'm going to think, oh, I wish she was here. But they really contributed a lot to this project, so I wanted to acknowledge them. I tried to tie in the theme of the mountain range here through our image, but I want to just briefly go over background of the project, talk a little bit about DPP, the methods used. I included a slide thinking about whether others with limited resources who want to try to do something like this in the way that we did it, thinking that might be helpful. But I'll spend most of the time talking about the findings from those focus groups and the recommendations that came out of that, and then just briefly some conclusions. So because people in the room know about DPP, that's great. I'll go quickly over this. We know that adults with prediabetes, it's a quite high estimate. I think in the United States it's somewhere like estimated to be 86 million. In New York State, the estimate's around 4.5 million. By having prediabetes, you are at high risk for type 2 diabetes. But the good news is that there's this prevention program, CDC certified evidence-based program that works on lifestyle change. The anecdotal evidence around this program is that there are some significant barriers to it, to participating and completing, and that's really the gist of what we're here to do. Just to give a sense of what the program is, it's a year-long program, and it's broken into two parts. So the first part is fairly intensive 16-week sessions, one-hour sessions, I think. It's called the core. The second part is spread out for monthly sessions, and I think it's about an hour a month over 6 to 8 months. And there's an individual coach, a facilitator, who works on content, but also engaging and group support and ongoing communication between sessions. And a variety of health topics are covered. I'm just going to look down to see some of those that I wanted to mention. So self-monitoring, weight, food intake, healthy eating, overcoming barriers to physical activity, problem solving, managing stress, and that's just some of the topics that are covered. Okay, so then this gives you a little picture of New York State and what we're working with. Through the 1422, we've funded four sub-awardees, one small, which is the one county in Albany, and the other are groups of counties. So our project, our local impact project, winds up covering 17 different counties in the state and identified through being high need for health burden and low socioeconomic status pockets within, not the entire county. So the methods for this study were to conduct, we asked each partnerships, and I'm going to try to remember to call them sub-awardees because that's more familiar. We asked each sub-awardee to go out and conduct at least one focus group in their high-need community, and to have the adult population in the focus groups, one of three categories, and it could be a mix, but we wanted folks who were had participated and completed the DPP lifestyle change program. We wanted folks who had participated and not completed, and we were also interested in the perspective of folks who were at high risk for type 2 diabetes or who actually had a diagnosis of prediabetes. So that was the group that we were interested. And layered over that is focusing on what we call priority populations, so the high health burden, low SES, high minority communities. So this is the slide I mentioned before that focuses a little bit on the how did we do it. We provided a lot of guidance and support. This screenshot gives you a two-pager, really succinct outline of what we shared with the subawardees for how to roll this out. The first part, the narrative, is just a little background and description. The table's broken down into two columns, and on the I think it's on the left-hand side, is the required the minimum required, so that like one focus group each, but along all the different steps of what are minimum requirements to do this. And then on the right hand side, I think we had recommended like what we'd really like to see. And it's hard, you're funding these subawardees, but they've got these 15 strategies among four different component areas. It's a pretty comprehensive 1422 project that we're rolling out. So when we made this ask, we wanted to provide as much support as possible and to not have our expectations too high, but to put it out there, like, it'd be great if you could do this. And then on the very bottom table is just a timeline, so we put in there what we the steps for conducting these focus groups and analyzing the data and reporting back, how long we thought each step would take, and then a due date, and it was pretty aggressive, I've got to say. I can't believe that they were able to do it. It's pretty incredible. So what was the purpose? Two-pronged purpose. One, we have to do an evaluation for this project, and we felt like this strategy around scaling and sustaining DPP was really important. So we focused one of our evaluation components on this, and this meets some of our requirements there. But more importantly, we wanted to understand what helps to facilitate enrollment and completion in this program, and then what are the barriers to enrollment and completion, with the overall goal of increasing enrollment and completion, pretty obvious. Okay, so here's some of the good news. There's a lot of good news with this project. It's rare to be able to present that way. So the four subawarded partnerships really met and surpassed our expectations. We had a total of 14 focus groups and a total of 160 participants. Now, I just want to say that it varied quite a bit. Some of the partnerships, I think one partnership had seven focus groups and another had two, so there was variation. And one of our partnerships was a bit creative, even though we gave these specific guidelines, and did a number of focus groups, but also included post-core survey questions, the questions that we, I forgot to mention when I talked about the guidance, that we also shared some other resources. We shared a template which had a script for conducting the focus groups. We shared a sample informed consent. We shared a document that was all about how to conduct focus groups, and in specific had a data analysis section, which I thought was pretty simple but good. So that one partnership actually wound up including surveys and including seven telephone interviews. So while we had 160 participants responding, really 130 of them were through the focus groups and the other 30 or so were from these other methods. But we decided to include it because they were on topic for our questions. So analysis and reporting, it's a unique method, but again, thinking about resources and how we pulled this off, it was sort of the most efficient way that we had to go. We asked the partnerships to capture the raw data, to transcribe the data and code that and analyze it, and we gave them some resources to do that. But then for our overall project, we basically used the reports as our data source, it's like a secondary data source, to come up with some common themes and pull together the information for the recommendations that we have. So I just wanted now spend most of my time on the findings, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about how we organize the findings based on the data we have. We'll start with talking about enrolling in the program, what were those facilitators and barriers, completing facilitators and barriers, and then recommendations. And there's some overlap in here. So this slide, there's a lot going on here. Basically, it's a table that talks about on your left-hand side, the facilitators to enrollment, and on the right-hand side, barriers to enrollment. And the interesting thing, not surprising though, are these green arrows where the concepts were the same, but depending on how they were implemented, whether they were implemented, the quality of what happened, it could be a barrier or a facilitator. I'll go into each of these, starting with facilitators. So a number one finding that came out, and I think this is a really important one, had to do, and it ties into some of the broader work on 1422 and our engagement with health systems and providers and trying to increase referrals and identification. It had to do with how important the medical provider is in facilitating enrollment, that individuals felt most comfortable from this group hearing from their medical provider, and that folks said that their medical provider prompted them to take action and to participate. Of course, family and friends can be a motivator. When family and friends were supportive, that was part of what we were hearing, but also family health history played a role in this too. Health issues were facilitators to enrollment, a desire to actually increase one's own health, and their own health challenges, whatever diseases that they were dealing with, feeling like they wanted to address that, desire to lose some weight, and also to prevent diabetes particularly, but also other chronic diseases. Cost and incentives, and this comes up a few times throughout the slides, as you'll see, but regarding enrollment, there was the fact that having a low-cost program was a real facilitator, having a free program was a facilitator, having programs that were covered through insurances or through the Y, very helpful, and then incentives, and in particular, incentives that were related to making changes, so maybe having a free Y membership was pretty common. Program logistics as well, the way the program is set up is it's very group focused and socially focused, so that worked well for some people, being in a group setting, having the support of other group members, the role of the facilitator, and again, this is where if it's done well, right, so if the facilitator was very supportive, a role model, engaging, maintained accountability, all those things were characteristics that people felt would help. So another part of it was how to provide new information in new ways to make changes, and that the program is already evidence-based, that it's had previous success. Also, someone said that the fact that it was, you know, which could be seen as a barrier, how long it is, and that comes up later, but that it was so comprehensive, right, that it was such a long program that gave some people confidence in doing it. Marketing, also a big factor to encourage enrollment, and it ranged from sort of passive marketing where there was information up at a doctor's office, at the front desk, just around, to more active where you had flyers or circulars or newsletters, and something very active is where an individual came into another class and talked a little bit about the DPP program and how that was effective in encouraging enrollment. All right, now I'll go on to barriers. This picture is really depressing, right? It's just like, but that's what we're dealing with when we're talking about barriers, right? So awareness and credibility, some people throughout the focus groups had never heard of it, no idea that this was an opportunity. In fact, some people, while we asked for the group that hadn't participated, people at risk for type 2 diabetes or with prediabetes, there were some people in the groups who were diabetic, and there was some hostility, the saying, wait, there's this great program out there, and I have never, how come nobody's told me about this, you know? So that just speaks to the need to get the word out. So the second part, unsure about the program, that had to do with feeling like, how valid is this program, and you know, is it trustworthy? Some lack of confidence in it, and so thinking about that, and then relating to that has to do with whether the program and the recommendations, the things that were being said, actually line up with their own provider's recommendations, and is there consistency there? Just as family and friends, though this one's more about family and individual, can be a facilitator, here it can be a barrier where family responsibilities, whether they're childcare, caring for other family members, can really limit one's ability and individual challenges, including health problems, energy time, just like what we all deal with to try to make changes, busy lives. Again, the cost of the program, and here it came up that ranging from cost in general to any cost at all. And this was sort of controversial because sometimes you hear, like, what's the expression, skin in the game, right? If there's like, if you're putting a little bit in, then you're more invested. But some of the messages we got from individuals in this group was that any cost was prohibitive. On the flip side about program and commitment and convenience, people did say that it felt like it was too long, that the expectations, the demands of the program seemed overwhelming, and also issues around convenience, location, time, scheduling, those sort of things. And then same, social supports. There were people who expressed discomfort with that group format and that group setting and not feeling like that would be a good environment for them. And then this last one I'm just going to skip because, you know, we're talking about enrollment here, so I'm not sure how that got in. Okay, so now I'd like to talk a little bit about barriers to completing the program, and there are some similarities. On the left-hand side, you'll see the facilitators, same thing on the right-hand side, the barriers, and again, the green arrow shows where the concepts are overlapping depending on how they're done, and I will go into each one. So program content and logistics, I thought it was really interesting that this was articulated, that it was a focus on lifestyle activities and not exercise or working out or diet or like this diet program, that was something that was appreciated once they were in it. This is lifestyle change. This isn't like I'm going on a diet or I'm going to start a new exercise plan. It's like, how do we make this change for life? How do we incorporate this? The program structure and content, so some people really felt that weekly meetings and logging were really helpful. The location, and in particular the location being at a place where you could actually be physically active, so like at a Y or a gym, help facilitate it, but also just in your community, at your church or library, somewhere easy to get to that would already be in your plan. Social reinforcements help facilitate, so having group and peer support, family and friends, making that connection, so other family members supporting you being part of this, but also really relating to people in your group, and desire to stay healthy for your family too. I thought that was an important one too, wanting to make sure to do that. And then again, that coach role, so was the coach supportive, engaging, positive, helping to facilitate the whole group dynamic. And then seeing change, you know, these outcomes as they were in the program really encouraged completing. So if folks were losing weight and they were increasing their self-confidence and they were feeling better both physically and emotionally. And then specific health indicators, so the A1C going down. So these things really helped. And then barriers to completion, I'm just going to go through these real quickly. And interestingly enough, we had limited barriers to completion included, and I think it makes sense when you think about our sample. We had over half of our sample were folks who had participated and completed in the program, so this speaks to our next steps too, and I'll get there in a second. But some of the barriers had to do with not liking to log the food, not liking the exercise was a deterrent. Some people said it was too much like Weight Watchers. Other people complained that it was not enough like Weight Watchers, so it was an interesting point of contention. Some people felt the class content was confusing or boring. Cost, as I said before, could be prohibitive. Ongoing to finish, maybe they felt they couldn't do it. And then scheduling and travel. So one thing that came up is that the time slots were often easier for retirees and not for working people. It's probably something you guys have heard before. So we tried to really focus our recommendations around actionable things, and we pulled recommendations from the documents, but then I also worked closely with my program partners at the New York State Department of Health to think about how we could send these recommendations back out to those sub-awardees and share them more broadly. And increasing awareness was a big thing. So both at the local level, saying, okay, we need to get out there and talk about promoting prediabetes prevention, and sharing information. There are a lot of materials on the CDC website, sharing those informations, highlighting what are the barriers and trying to work around them, encouraging participation, but also nationally and statewide, having broader reach with this information, sharing about diabetes, diabetes risk, having campaigns, all that sort of stuff. And then regarding marketing, thinking about how to frame the message and what were the best ways to frame it. So an opportunity to make lasting change. And then also focusing on weight loss as a key benefit to this program since it has been proven to do that. Effective referrals measures, going back to that initial slide on recommendations with the provider, really engaging providers, academic detailing, around how to refer to this program, identify and then refer to this program as needed. And then keeping costs low or free and providing incentives. Also, as one of the other 1422 strategies, is actually working to increase coverage for the benefits, so through local employers. Okay, and then regarding completion, there were a number of ways to improve the program. So certain group activities were encouraged to make it more interactive, culturally appropriate activities, covering certain topics, so things like cooking on a limited budget, how to deal with healthy food choices at public events. These are all things we all struggle with, you know. Though CSTE has made it pretty easy for us. They've given some healthy snacks. Improving resources and tools, holding classes at venues that are integrated into a participant's life. Okay, and I'm just gonna wrap up. I can go into recommendations more, but I want to talk a little bit about low-cost health foods, and that in particular with one of the strategies for 1422 is working in small retail stores. So we're trying to link up this strategy with also food retail in the community and thinking about how we can offer low-cost healthy opportunities. My limitations, the sample representation overall, we did capture the priority population, but there were a few focus groups that were done in convenient locations, and we didn't get the population we were interested in those groups, but overall. And then this was the big one, which is really important, that individuals who started the program but didn't complete it were so underrepresented in this focus group sample. We heard from a couple of them, and in particular, I just want to highlight this, there was one man who really expressed frustration that the coaches and the other group participants were not male, and he felt uncomfortable and out of place. So based on that, well, I'll talk a little bit about my conclusions. Yes, we were able to identify barriers and facilitators to DPP, so that was great. We met our requirement there. We were able to really target some actionable key recommendations to our sub-awardees and have a report that we can share, and I'm sharing them here with you, which is great. But I think I want to talk most about, I know I probably used up my time and I want to give some time for questions, but that our next step is that we've designed, and it's so exciting to have a next step that we're actually rolling out right now this summer. I was able to get a summer intern through the local School of Public Health who's working with me, and we're designing a telephone interview for non-completers specifically. So we're reaching out to our four sub-awarded communities and asking for them to do a consent to contact process where they're reaching out to non-completers in the last couple of years, hopefully more recent so they'll remember stuff. And then we're going to reach out to them, do informed consent, and conduct a telephone interview. Hopefully it'll be less burden on them than a focus group, right? We're calling them more personal. They'll feel more comfortable, hopefully, sharing their experience. So hopefully by the end of this summer, I'll have some data on the non-completers as well to add to this. Thank you. Sorry for going over a bit.
We have a couple of minutes for questions and answers.
It's just to find out why. That would be a great outcome, and I would guess that would be, you know, that like unintended consequence might happen for some, but we're not in the position to set up enrollment. Though they're being contacted by the program for that consent to contact, so right there, that's making that connection alive again. So that is something that's good to think about. Right. So it varies slightly for each of our partnerships, but the 1422 has five health system strategies, so we're lucky that we've already got those relationships. So each of our partnerships is working with health systems within their communities, and they're working on things like identifying people with undiagnosed hypertension, hypertension lack of control, and prediabetes. So then they put in place things where they, once they have a registry of folks who they've identified have prediabetes, they do outreach to them about the programs in the areas. And there are also community health workers who are charged with doing some screening around prediabetes, referring back to the doctors or the health system, somebody in the health system, sometimes it's a care coordinator, and getting that referral back out. So, but the actual like how-to and steps, each program has sort of designed their own, and they're slightly different in how they do them.
Department of Health?
No. Well, a couple of them are from a local health department, and some of them are hired by the partnerships as staff, and some of them are integrated into the health systems, which is the ideal role. So it varies slightly. Right. I don't yet. In fact, I'm like anxious about this consent to contact process. We just did a training on it. There was a little bit of a pushback. There's no more money in the budget to pay for people to make those calls, so it's going to be challenging. We'll have more information once we start receiving consent to contact forms. I've already forgotten your second. Yes, okay. So one of the concerns about, we had this goal of trying to reach 40 individuals, and we are concerned as to whether we'll be able to do that. So I have been thinking about, would we send, if we can't get through, is there a way, at this point we're asking for telephone, home phone, cell phone, and text, but is there a way to get a mailing address? How accurate will that be? Can we send a follow-up? But I think we want to give this telephone interview a chance, and if we're not successful, then maybe we'll have to go down that path.
One more question.
I work at the testing department of my administration, and we do benefits administration, and we're getting ready to offer the DPP as a public benefit for our employees. And so we're working with our wellness program that we're offering to think about incentives, and we're also worried about referrals from medical providers, which we're hoping we'll be able to push through our insurance providers, Blue Cross and Shield, Cigna.
Right. I don't have any specific information, but I think the workplace setting speaks to, addresses one of the barriers. If you're working it into a person's daily activity and making it easier, that's going to increase the possibility for them to participate. I'm thinking back to the data, other things that they talked about regarding incentives. Well, some of the things could be as simple as, like doing cooking demonstrations. It's not an incentive, but it makes it much more engaging and people have more fun with it. Also, I remember someone, one of the points being like rotating, like doing visits to other exciting places, making it more engaging as well. So again, it doesn't specifically answer your question, but I think in general, keeping the cost down, it sounds like you're already doing it. It's covered. And you're making it convenient, so you're starting off in the right place,
So let us thank all three wonderful presenters.